Hello, and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 111.
This week on the podcast, Tuesday's primary elections bring mixed results for wacko candidates from both parties.
And GOP patriots are now in favor of leaving behind POWs, because hey, screw due process.
Republicans, hell-bent on fixing the VA, may or may not be in support of a new bipartisan bill to fix the VA.
And it's the time of the month where we report jobs numbers and update you on how last month's jobs numbers were totally incorrect.
Seattle residents are already reaping the super awesome benefits of electing a socialist to their city council with massive minimum wage increases.
And as if we needed it, further proof that Vladimir Putin is a disgusting sleazebag.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Yes, and you should.
And you should. And you should find us everywhere else, because that's what you should be doing. We're coming to you from two different coasts tonight. So
exciting.
If this sounds really funny, that's why. But I think we're working on some tech solutions that I feel
We have a suspect system going on that we think is going to work.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't, then you're going to get to listen to an interesting podcast.
Exactly.
But you always get to listen to a more interesting podcast.
It's going to be it'll be exciting in new and different ways this time around.
Right.
I'm sure you've heard.
Wherein we might not be having a conversation together.
Right. We might just be talking about our own
issues. Two separate conversations jammed together in post.
Yeah.
That don't have anything to do with each other.
It's going
to
be awesome. Yes. And this was an exciting week because
it was
an election week.
Election weeks. And that's what we live for.
Right.
As you know.
That's why we podcast, is for an election week.
And it was not just an election week, but it was an election week that we got to vote in.
Yeah. So that makes it extra special because we love voting.
We do. We
really
do. We
don't fucking kid around when it comes to voting. No.
And you know who we got to vote for this week?
Yeah.
Sandra Fluke. How exciting was that?
That was pretty great. And it was
the reason that this podcast exists.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She was our entry point into the world of podcasting.
Yeah, it was her and Rush Limbaugh's.
It always comes back to Sandra Fluke. I feel like once a year we have a Sandra Fluke moment where we're like, oh, she's still here. Well, and so this was an especially important election in California because of the jungle primary system. It was primary day. Mm-hmm. It meant that everyone and their mother was running in this election, and we got to choose our favorite two. Of a million people. So Sandra Fluke was running in a kind of weird state Senate race that had her with Patrick Verone, who used to be the head of the Writers Guild, and he was the head of the Writers Guild when they had their big strike. And then a bunch of other crazies. Somebody named Ben Allen, who is the winner of the race, but was, as far as I was concerned, the least famous person in it. I could be wrong.
Yeah, how'd he do that?
Who is he? Like, he must be somebody. We just don't. We weren't following Ben Allen because we were so, you know, excited about Sandra Fluke being in the race.
We voted for her.
I
think you did too.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah.
And this was actually my first successful California voting experience because the last time I tried to vote in California, they let me vote and then they were like, "Oh, but it's going to have to be a provisional ballot because of some fake reason because we can't verify your address or something ridiculous." And listen, like, if I have the ID with the address, then I have the address. Like, I don't know why. You would be trying to stop me from voting as a person who loves voting. It just doesn't make sense to try to stop someone who loves voting from voting.
No,
stop someone who doesn't care. But then in other California news, this was the Marianne Williamson election.
Yes, it was.
Henry Waxman's
seat.
Exactly. Her and all the Democrats in California were running for that seat.
Correct.
To the degree that though about 70% of the vote went to Democrats, a Republican won the primary.
Right. It was so funny, too, because the next day I saw there was a headline on Drudge Report where it was like, shock primary, Republican wins Henry Waxman's seat. And it's just sort of like, okay, that is technically what happened. A Republican did technically win that primary. But all the people voted for Democrats. There were just 1,000 of them.
It doesn't count.
So the lone wolf Republican wins the primary because 80% of people voted for Democrats, or 70, or however many it was.
Yeah. No, and Marianne Williamson did not win of the Democratic nominees on that ballot. Ted Lieu, who I think is a state senator here, who I think he actually has the seat that Sandra Fluke is running for. Or I could be wrong about that.
Oh, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. He and there's it's funny because there's a Ted Lieu in New York too. So There's a lot of people named Ted Lieu in politics, as it turns out, I guess. I don't know what that was supposed to share with you guys. But Marianne Williamson was one of the lower scoring Democrats on that ballot, despite...
Yeah. Actually, and I think that she technically was running without party, I think.
Yeah, no, she was. She was running with that fake party that they have here that's not a real party.
I mean, she's a Democrat, ultimately, when it comes down to it. But yeah, she was. She didn't have a party affiliation.
No, well, how could she? There were like 500 Democrats running in that race.
I know. Well, and the funny thing is that I think I said this to you the next morning, I was like, this is not our seat. Adam Schiff is our congressperson, so we didn't get to vote in
it.
Did
you vote for him?
I would have voted for Marianne Williamson for a couple reasons, which I've talked about already, but I really did sort of like want her to make it just for entertainment purposes.
Yeah, Brent's real into the entertainment.
And I kept saying, I was like, God, I hope she, I know, I was like, God, I really hope she gets it, I really hope she gets it. But, like, then when she didn't get it, I really sort of, like, felt kind of good about it the next morning because, like, so many of my, like, annoying Facebook friends had really been posting, like, positive, you know, affirmation quotes from Marianne Williamson about, you know, returning to love and joining the Williamson campaign and liking her on Facebook. And, like, I really felt good the next morning knowing that they were getting no pleasure.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. And I know that that's a terrible thing to say because a few of them are actually my friends. But, like, I was getting overwhelmed with the
love.
Cheesy Marianne Williamson quotes
much love.
In my Facebook feed. Too much.
It was a kind of gross amount of love. And I think you said something earlier this week on iChat that was something like, I can really get behind, like, the getting corrupt money out of politics, but no one's looking for love in politics. Like,
exactly.
No one wants any part of that.
Well, and she talks about returning to love all the time. And that next morning, I was like, I'm really feeling good about returning to hate.
Yeah.
Like, that just... I was really reveling in
politics,
that the next morning,
people.
knowing that she didn't make it.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's for entertainment. That's bad. But I mean, who needs her?
For seriousness, it's good. For the world's
exactly.
level of seriousness.
Oh, and you know who didn't make it? You know who else was running in that race? Was what's her face? Who ran for mayor?
Oh yeah, Wendy
Gruhl.
Thank
she got
God.
Third.
Yeah.
But thank
screw
God.
Her.
I almost said poor Wendy Gruhl, but I don't actually mean that because
no.
she's but boring person, but she's had a real rough go of it here in LA the last couple of years. Because she was sort of like the, you know, the favorite daughter to be the mayor, and the Clintons came out and endorsed her and everything because she's a Clintonite, and she didn't win that. And now she probably, you know, had she been, you know, one of only three Democrats running in this race, she would have been second place because the Republican would have come in last, basically. So, I mean, she's really just, she's had a tough go of it. I don't care, but
no,
I mean, you know.
I'm not interested, but I'm,
no,
I felt a little smug about that, as a matter of fact.
I felt smug about that, too. Yeah. There were good things to feel smug about after our election.
Totally.
On Wednesday morning.
Meanwhile, we were not the only state that had primaries last week.
No, it was a big primary day.
It was a big primary day in a lot of states, and one of the other exciting primaries was the Republican primary for Tom Harkin's seat.
Yes.
Which is exciting for sad reasons, I think, because a total wacko won that race.
Right. And it was interesting, too, because, well, first off, this is the first time there's been an open Senate race in Iowa since 1974, because we have two, like, lifer senators. We have Tom Harkin and Chuck Grassley, who have both been around forever. One's a Democrat, one's a Republican, but they both keep winning every single time. They're basically, they can't be defeated.
They're institutions.
So, they're institutions. Yeah, exactly. So, Tom Harkin is retiring, and Bruce Braley is a Democratic nominee who basically ran unopposed for the most part. He is, he's in the House of Representatives right now, represents sort of like the eastern part of the state, Cedar Rapids area, I think. And anyway, but there was a fairly heated Republican primary going on, or at least everyone thought it was heated, but someone sort of pulled away at the end. Her name is Joni Ernst, and she's a real wackadoo.
I think we mentioned her before, because didn't we talk about the castrating hogs ad at some point? Maybe we just talked about that amongst ourselves. But she's a state senator in Iowa, right? And she had this weird ad where she was talking about she made some symbolic sort of metaphorical comment about castrating hogs in one of her ads.
Yeah.
Got a lot of press.
Yeah. She worries me a little bit just because, you know, she's got sort of a decent story. I mean, she's been to Iraq. She also sort of like grew up in a, you know, a farm family. And Bruce Braley is sort of, he's the type of person who could get elected in Iowa, but he's also sort of like, He's a lawyer. He's also sort of like, I think we talked on the podcast recently about how he like made some, you know, defamatory remarks about farmers, like where he said, do you want a farmer? Because he's like on some committee, he's on the judicial committee, and he was like, do you really want a farmer running the judicial committee, or do you want a lawyer? And he caught a lot of flack for that. Like, she's going to be able to sort of like juxtapose herself against him in a way, I think, that will probably like make her likable. I think that she might, thankfully enough for everyone in the entire country, be a little bit too crazy to get elected statewide there. Yeah. And especially in a Republican primary in Iowa, as we know, the Republicans in Iowa are like wackier than sort of like the general electorate in Iowa. She had to take some like total loon bag stances on things. So I think that I'm hoping that she's going to be too much to handle. I mean, Sarah Palin was there stumping for her. Marco Rubio was there. I mean, this is the type of person that she is.
Yeah.
So, and also a woman
she's
is
the
not
Sarah
one,
Palin but, type of person.
Yeah, exactly. But the other thing she has going for her, a woman has never held statewide office in Iowa, which is sort of a little crazy.
Wow.
I know, it's bizarre, right?
Yeah.
We've never had a governor, a United States senator, or member of Congress.
You have these sort of like institutions of senators.
Well, right,
you have,
exactly.
I mean, that's
an
like
institution
you
governor
have,
too.
Exactly. So it's sort of the
yeah.
But this, she's like in the National Guard, like still actively, because the article
she
was
is.
Talking about how she's like going to do a state tour, but then it has to stop at a certain point because she's going to be back on National Guard duty or something.
Right, exactly. So. Well, and it's interesting, too, because she really pulled away, too, which is the other thing that sort of concerns me, because, like, the polls leading up to that primary sort of, like, had her. The big question days before the primary was whether she was going to get 35% to avoid it going to a convention fight, and she got well over 35%.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, because she was supposedly polling right at it, and she won, I think she got, like, almost half the vote or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, she
got
did.
Almost 50%. I mean, she got well over the 35, so I'm a little nervous about her, but hopefully she's nutty enough that, you know, we can not have to worry about it at a certain point. But
and
right
then,
now, she scares me.
Well, and Mississippi has a sort of exciting primary situation happening as well.
Oh, yeah.
Because, so their incumbent senator,
right,
Cochran.
Who is also an institution.
Who is another institution. He was running for his seventh term and is now in a runoff with a Tea Party challenger. And the runoff is in 3 weeks, so it's pretty soon. But it's like real chaos over there. Like, the party establishment doesn't really know who to support because they obviously just want to go with whoever's going to win because they're not having brilliant ideas in the Mississippi GOP. And it's been a really expensive primary race. They've already spent like $8 million on the primary race. And the attacks have been like super personal, which has made for an exciting race, if nothing else.
Yeah. And they were within 1 point of each other in this primary.
Exactly. It was like a razor-thin margin. The difference was literally 2,500 votes, which is concerning for them because now they're basically polling neck and neck, and now they are kind of worried that, you know, McDaniel, who's the Tea Party challenger, is, you know, kind of an off-the-cuff crazy person, you know, who says nutty things and, you know, has all the things going for him that Tea Party people have going for them. But he is expected to have a little bit of a boost in the runoff because, like, only the real crazies are going to be, like, out for the runoff. Like, runoffs are when crazy people come out to vote. So they're expecting that that Cochran is going to have a little bit of a challenge on his hands if they're running this neck and neck now and they're expecting runoff voters to make the decision. The other weird thing that happened was that Cochran got, like, this last-minute boost because there was this weird incident where a bunch of pro-McDaniel people, like, were charged with a conspiracy to break into the nursing home that Cochran's wife is in because she has progressive dementia and, like, take photographs of her. Which is, like, such a weird...
What is that?
Like, don't be doing that.
Like, what are those photographs get you anyway?
Right, like that Cochran had a wife who had to be put in a home? Like, what is that? Teach us. Well, but part of their narrative has been that Cochran is too old. So I think it was probably part of that plan. You know, they basically, they're trying to raise questions about his age, and then they're accusing him of loving Obama or whatever they always accuse people of when they're trying to be Tea Partiers. And, you know, McDaniel has basically been accused of being like a nutbag, which he is, so that's correct. But apparently McDaniel sort of fashions himself after Ted Cruz a bit, so... He's probably a pretty exciting guy.
Yeah, well, and I there was a whole story about, and it was in Politico, basically, too, that the Democrats are really watching this big time because, you know, normally the Mississippi is not a place where the Democrats have any intention of going and running against anyone because, like, hello, it's in Mississippi. Right. But they're sort of thinking that if McDaniel wins, he might just be nutty enough. You know, he sort of has the – he could be sort of like a Todd Akin or a Richard Murdoch-y type mm-hmm. character, you know, like who is just crazy enough to be too crazy to be elected to statewide office, regardless of whether it's in Mississippi or not.
Yeah, so, no, sort of exciting. Well, it's exciting too because the Tea Party has been sort of recently not faring so well in a lot of these primaries, I think because people realized yes, they were unelectable in the general. And this, so this is the first time that they're really, this is like one of the biggest boosts that they've had in a long time. Because this is major to oust a seven-term or six-term senator. But it leaves like this, it will do what all Tea Party victories in the past have done and leave like this brilliant opening for the Democrats in a state that they have no business winning if it happens. And that could make for a very exciting race. So the runoff is in a few weeks, and that will be exciting for its own reasons. And then hopefully we'll have a real exciting race on our hands. Because then we could be...
Like a Mississippi Democrat versus a crazy person. Like, that's like a race that you need to be paying attention to.
That's a race you want to watch. Yeah. It's. Meanwhile, in non-election news, we're still weighed down with this dumb nonsense with this POW that we rescued from Afghanistan. Basically, the right-wing media has lost their minds, which is not surprising. But they have been reporting... Like, on, you know, basically they've tried to turn him into, like, an enemy combatant. And they're, you know, they're angry that we traded five, you know, Guantanamo prisoners / terrorists that, you know, for him. And Obama went on Brian Williams this week and a bunch of other media outlets. He had to talk about why that's a thing that you do. And he made, I think, a fair point, which is, you know, he keeps getting accused of negotiating with terrorists. And he was like, well, you don't do prisoner exchange with your friends. Like...
Right.
That's you do it with your enemies. So true.
Well, and the thing is, and I heard because this is sort of one of those things where, like, I think that the right wing has sort of, like, done a good job of, you know, in the media sort of, like, questioning this. And I heard, because, like, you know, there are sort of questions about, you know, Bergdahl and, like, was he a deserter and was he the, and those are all sort of, like, fair questions to ask. But I think that I was, Anthony Weiner, who is just always winning at everything except Twitter,
except his personal life,
basically. Yeah. Right, exactly. Was on Bill Maher this week, and they were, of course, talking about this. And he put it best for me, anyway, where he said, can't you have the thought in your head that you want to bring home all the POWs and also then give them due process when they get back, in the sense that, like, if he – both of those things are American values – if he was a deserter, and if he did do something wrong, we have things in America, like the court system, or, you know, like, to figure out whether he did do those things. Whether he did those things or not are not reason to leave him with the Taliban.
Right,
you can, you know, like, it's okay to think that he was a deserter, but just because he may have been a deserter is not reason to not bring him home and figure those things out, sort of like, you know, with... due process, which is an American ideal. Well, you should be able to have both of those thoughts in your head at the same time.
I feel like it doesn't make... It's the idea that they're, like, trying to turn him into, like, an enemy combatant instead of a deserter. Being a deserter is different than being an enemy combatant. He was in this terrible war that we shouldn't have gone into in the first place, A. And B, he was in this horrible circumstance where a lot of other people from his unit talk about how challenging the circumstances were that they were in at the time, and that this was, you know, that he had sort of expressed concerns about this. That is different than aiding the terrorists, which I feel like right-wing media is not making that distinction very well, / at all, / they're not even trying to make that distinction, because it's a much more salacious story if they can talk about him being an enemy combatant. But it's adding sort of unnecessary, like, drama to this story, because it's sort of just there to sort of further their agenda at the expense of this poor guy who's been in fucking Taliban captivity for 5 years. Like, whether or not he was a deserter, I don't know that he deserved to be in, you know, a prisoner of the Taliban for 5 years. Like, that's not sort of like,
no,
like you said, that you have to be able to hold those thoughts in your head, you know, at the same time. He may have been a deserter. That's one thing that is not the same thing as being an enemy combatant, and it's not the same thing as deserving, you know, what he got. Like,
right.
And well, either way, he's having... he was an American citizen that was a prisoner of the Taliban abroad. Like, whether or not he was being a responsible soldier is sort of besides the point. Like, we should try to get all American prisoners out from, you know, enemy prisons just in life.
Well, having two thoughts in their head is not a specialty of theirs. Having one thought in their head is not like
also a
thing
challenge
that they're really excelling at. Right. So the fact that they're not able to hold two at the same time should come as of no surprise to anyone.
Fair enough.
Anyway.
Yeah, they're creating a single thought for us because they can't have the two thoughts. So they thought they would drive this into a different narrative that allows them to hold just one thought in their mind.
Bingo.
So it's exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. So other scandal update this week.
Yes.
The VA, of course, we've talked about a lot. We have a potential deal struck with some sort of interesting bedfellows this week.
So
with
weird.
John McCain and Bernie Sanders.
Like,
so that's sort of odd. But I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders is the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee chairman and John McCain is John
himself.
McCain. So, I mean, it sort of makes a moderate amount of sense that they would be working on this together. But, you know, it's got a lot of things in it that both sides wanted. It's some things that have even already passed separately. It sort of, you know, it's a fairly broad proposal. It authorizes spending $500 million to hire more doctors and nurses and to allow veterans to be cared for outside of the overburdened VA system. It also gives the next veteran secretary greater authority to fire their employees for incompetence, which sounds weird that we didn't sort of already have that, but, you know, regardless. So, I mean, you can sort of tell reading off that list which things are things that the Democrats wanted and which things are ones that Republicans wanted.
Republicans love a chance to fire people.
Yes. They wanted that, and they also wanted people to be able to be cared for outside
the system. Yeah. And the Democrats wanted more money.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I mean, I'm surprised that those two are in this together, and I'm not surprised because I feel like in my mind, I imagine that all of the like grumpy old men wandering around the Senate like probably go to dinner parties together all the time. Like, one of the things about John McCain that I always have to remind myself is he's friends with a lot of the people that he's enemies with. Like, he was like a friend of the Clintons. Like, he would hang out with the Clintons, even though they didn't necessarily agree on things. And my guess is that him and Bernie Sanders don't, like, socialize by themselves, but I bet they find themselves at dinner together more often than you would expect. So I feel like this was such an easy win for everyone. Nobody's trying to look like they hate the veterans.
Well, and that's the thing that I was going to say about this sort of relationship, too, is McCain obviously is himself a veteran. And, you know, and there was, I think he was quoted as saying, you know, calling Bernie Sanders like a real fighter on these issues. And like, whether John McCain thinks that spending, you know, $1 billion on this is the right answer or not, John McCain can't argue with the fact that this is Bernie Sanders' pet issue. So he has to sort of like give props to Bernie Sanders for like trying to fix this. I mean, Bernie Sanders has been introducing veterans bills for decades.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, maybe not decades, but for a long time that the Republicans have been shooting down. So
would it be crazy
John
if
McCain
it was
sort
decades?
Of like has to...
I feel like it's probably been decades. He's been there for about 7 billion years. I mean, that...
I know. Well, he's 1,000.
He's 1,000 years old. They're both 1,000 years old.
Yeah. But, of course, you know, God knows whether it's going to pass, even though it seems like it should, because they both... the bill has things that everybody loves and everybody hates, but the Republicans are probably already starting to potentially get hung up on how it's going to get paid for, because supposedly the cost is going to be coming out of emergency supplemental spending, and it's more emergency supplemental, it's going to cost more supplemental spending than was in the initial budget, so they're probably going to, you know, be losers about it and to talk about how we can't pay for it and things like that, but who knows, maybe they'll actually pass it. I think the Senate will certainly pass it.
I think the Senate will pass it. The House isn't in the business of passing things, so you can never know with them. It's not their move. Meanwhile, jobs numbers, in a surprise turn of events, I found the jobs numbers on the internet this week by accident entirely. Like, I had basically been looking for other stories, any other stories that were not about the jobs numbers, and was forced to reckon with them.
I know.
So we fake added 217,000 jobs in May. The big news of the week was that that brings us back to the pre-recession levels. So the jobs gap that we had to make up is has been made up. Turns out most of those jobs are crappy jobs. So it's not been awesome because
replacing... Well, and also those are just very sort of like technical numbers because while we regained all of those jobs, like if we would have sort of like, you know, if we would have been sort of, if we would have continued with job creation instead of going, you know, into the you know, economic downturn, then we're still short by like 7 million jobs.
Exactly.
So we didn't, we technically now have the same amount of jobs as we did before the recession, but that's nothing to really write home about.
That's not the right number of jobs for America, if that's what you're imagining.
No.
And we just slightly beat the expected number of jobs, but obviously since all of these numbers will be revised, we have no way of knowing whether we met our expectations at all. The unemployment rate remained at 6.3%. That, too, is a fake measure of whether or not people are employed because, as we've discussed many times, if you are not looking for work, you are not considered unemployed, even if you have a crappy life and can't find work because, you know, you've been out of work for 2 years. So all of that withstanding, everyone was fake enthused about the jobs numbers because of the gap being made up. And then we immediately had to have a lot of news about why that wasn't such a great thing. So now we're back to where we started.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, in news about jobs, the most exciting news of the week about jobs was that on Tuesday, the mayor of Seattle signed a bill that will gradually increase the minimum wage in Seattle to $15 an hour. We have previously reported that SeaTac, which is the town that the Seattle-Tacoma airport is in, had announced an immediate $15 an hour minimum wage that was going to go into effect immediately, as immediate would indicate. And Seattle then started looking into doing this, and they obviously had a lot more factors at play because it's a much bigger city. But basically what happened was they had a bunch of activist pressure and a bunch of strikes, especially in the food service industry. And then they had this weird election cycle where they got a socialist into the city council.
Hoorah! So, yes.
Yeah, so they have this woman who ran and won as a socialist who was sort of championing this issue. And then basically couldn't even vote for the final version of the law because of some politicking that was going on. But it basically is going to increase the minimum wage over time so that I think within 7 years or something, they're going to have gone up to $15 an hour, but it increases it at different rates for small businesses and big businesses. And it sounds like it was a compromise, but it was sort of like a great compromise because it got, you know, everyone to agree on this thing that's crazy. I don't even have words for what it is. It's just exciting.
I know. Well, it's so amazing because, like, I mean, it's awesome because they were able to get this compromise. And then also the other thing that they did, and this is a thing Republicans have been talking about for a long time, is, you know, tying the minimum wage increase to inflation. And but, you know, you sort of, which is great and we can do that, but it's sort of like, well, you can't tie it to inflation until you get it high enough to where, like, once you tie it to inflation, that then it will still be a living wage.
Exactly.
So that's like, so that's the thing that they did here is that after it finally gets up to $15, that's when it's going to be tied to inflation. So then in theory, you don't ever really have to worry about this again. You don't have to have an argument about whether you're going to raise the minimum wage and what it should be and et cetera, because you've now got it to a reasonable place. A lot of people think it should probably be higher than $15. I think Elizabeth Warren has been talking about how if it had been sort of tied to inflation from when we first set it, it should be something like $22 an hour. But, I mean, at least $15 is a little bit more reasonable than, like, what's the federal minimum wage right now?
It's like $7 or something.
I mean, it's like $7 or something. So it's like twice the federal minimum wage.
And a lot of places are struggling to even get it to $10 an hour, which is comically low already. And they're going to allow... Certain businesses will be able to factor in some of the other, you know, compensation that they offer, like healthcare and you know, retirement benefits and stuff like that, so that they will have a little bit longer to comply. But I think at the end of the day, the maximum number of years that you can take to comply will be 7. And that's for small businesses that are small. They also, the way that they labeled small business was that you were small if you had under 500 employees, but nationwide. So no big businesses can go into Seattle and be like, oh, but we only have 498 employees in Seattle. Because if you're fucking Walmart, you still, you know, have to be.
You have at least 3 other employees elsewhere in the country.
Exactly.
So
that was very exciting. And then also Obama endorsed Elizabeth Warren's student loan plan, which was good news as well.
Right. And that's a pretty drastic overhaul. It's going to allow, you know, students or whoever, you know, whoever took out the loan to like save thousands of dollars, because it's going to let them basically like renegotiate their interest, their loan interest rate from these like high rate existing loans, to like much lower interest rates. So, that's like huge news.
Yeah. That's 50% of the way to where we should be in the first place, which is where we shouldn't have interest rates on our student loans that in any way tied to the private market.
Well, and that's the thing that Elizabeth Warren has been talking about forever. Right. Like the fact that that the federal government makes so much money off of student loans is sort of it's sickening, really. I mean,
it's gross. So, and it also, considering how many articles have been coming out in the last few years about what the loan debt is for young people at the moment, which is like massively crazy.
Oh, I know.
I was talking about this with my parents at lunch today, and we were both like, how did it go up so much even from the time that I went to college, which was it was less than a decade ago. I don't know it got so much
more
expensive.
Coupled with the fact that there's no jobs for them to have once they graduate.
Exactly.
I mean, it makes these loans even worse than they are, because nobody has any way to pay for it in the first place.
Well, and we were talking about it in the context of all of these articles. So there was like a rash of articles about how dumb and lazy millennials are. That's been going on for a while, because generations who cause problems love to blame other generations for being victims of their problems. So the 80s generation that caused all this bullshit is now mad that millennials are so lazy because they're living on their parents' couch and not getting jobs. Now, obviously, we know that there are not jobs for them to get, and they're living on their parents' couch not because it's so awesome to live with your mom and dad, but because they can't afford to move out. But recently I've noticed there's been a wave of sort of counterpoint articles where like the Times even had an editorial today that was about like stop blaming millennials for this bullshit. But there's been, you know, it used to be that HuffPo was just filled with things about how dumb and lazy millennials are.
Yes.
And now it's filled with people commenting on how dumb and lazy it is to blame millennials for financial problems that were caused by the Reagan generation. Because it's those fucking Reagan people. It's the people that are in their 40s now that are like the real assholes here, I've decided.
I know. Well, and it's going to be, you know, this is sort of like part of what the Democrats are calling their fair shot strategy heading into the midterms, like where they're basically just like going to bring up a bunch of votes about things that they think are going to energize their base and really anybody who has a brain, because they're basically forcing the Republicans to vote on things that they know that Americans like that the Republicans are going to vote no on, because this is probably not going anywhere. It's probably actually going nowhere fast. Because also, you know, the way that they're going to pay for this, because obviously they're going to lose money on these lower interest rates loans. So the way that they're, you know, going to offset like that money lost on these loans is to raise taxes on the wealthy, which is, of course,
obviously,
you know,
that's
we're
not gonna pass
we're in favor of at any moment. But like, that's a non-starter with Republicans. So like, this is dead on arrival. But, you know, it's I like this idea of forcing them to vote on some of these things, because like, let's have it out with all of this.
No, exactly.
Like, let's
get
let's have a national vote on the $15 minimum wage too.
Right.
Let's make them vote on that. Like, make them vote on all of these things that like everyone, you know, every thinking person agrees with, that except Republicans.
Exactly. No, it's what's been, I think, especially shameful about the way that that Congress has been operating for the last few years is that they don't go on the record about anything other than hating Obamacare.
Right.
Like, no one is on the record about student loans at all, because they're not voting.
Yeah,
on
they should.
They just come up with ideas and then they dismiss them.
Right. They should have to go on the record about hating students.
Yeah, exactly. They should be forced to go on the record about hating all the people that they hate, which is most people.
Exactly.
All the people. Now, in other exciting news, which is mostly interesting to me because I'm currently in New York, Brooklyn is making a bid for the Democratic National Convention this year, which is sort of, I have mixed feelings about this. I'm interested in it because I think usually there have been many Democratic and Republican conventions, even at Madison Square Garden. That's like a place that you throw a convention if you're looking to convent together. This is the first time that Brooklyn is throwing a bid in. I think it's partially just de Blasio is very Brooklyn proud because he's from Brooklyn. So that's, I think, part of it. But it's an interesting idea, not because I want the convention to be in New York because it's a pain in the ass for everyone when any of these major events come to New York, but because it would be sort of a symbol that the party is aligning itself with a more progressive Democrat as opposed to trying to jump to the middle. You know, the other people that are bidding for this are, there are some other cities that are sort of liberal strongholds, but a lot of the time they choose to do these things in swing states, which I always think is dumb because your base doesn't live in swing states. You're trying to get your base excited at a convention. You don't, the swing state thing comes later when you start dumbing right. everything down and, you know, hedging on everything. But like, you don't start from a point of hedging. You end at the point of hedging. So it's sort of exciting to me that there's this option. And this is, you know, de Blasio is a friend of the Clintons. He is sort of in bed with the Clintons. So it's not yeah. unreasonable to think that they, you know, could go for this, especially if Hillary ends up being the nominee, which blah, but well, like.
Right, because,
you know,
right. I mean, she was a senator
here.
New York.
Yeah, she, you know, the Clintons sort of fake lived here or live here, depending on what mood they're in. They're very right. much, you know, they're very much connected to the evil financial people in the city and other evil people, but also powerful people in the city and state. Yeah. I mean, this, but it would be sort of an interesting message to send if Brooklyn, which is like at this point probably the most progressive of the progressive boroughs, because that's where sort of yuppies are moving. You know, Manhattan is filled with people who can afford to live in Manhattan, which is rich people, and they're not right. necessarily progressives. But Brooklyn is where the progressives are right now. So this would be like, this would be, I think, an interesting departure. And I would recommend it to the Democrats because I think that they make, it's a foolish mistake to focus on swing states early in the election cycle the way that they do, because it makes your base sort of feel blah about you because you end up talking about issues that most people in America don't care about. Because most of their base lives in cities, and they end up talking to all these people in fucking, you know, Ohio who are working in auto plants and are not the people that actually vote for them at the end of the day. So, like, I think it would be a good place to start.
Right, and it doesn't guarantee you anything either. I mean, no. You know, we had the convention in Charlotte in 2012, and Obama didn't win North Carolina. I mean, so if you're doing it in some sort of, like, you know, as some like crackpot plan to like win a state that you might not otherwise. It's like having the convention there doesn't do that for you.
Anything.
I mean, it's just, you can
swing
have it wherever
voters,
you want. Have it in.
Have it on Mars.
Have it in
swing
Los Angeles if you want.
Are not watching. See, I see this as a way to engage base voters that they don't normally engage during the election cycle because they don't stop in places like New York or like LA unless they want money. And so you start to feel as a voter in those places like your thoughts don't matter. And that's, I think, a problem. I think that's something that Obama was able to overcome because he was young and he was sort of hip and he was able to connect with urban voters. And that's something that, like, a Hillary Clinton is not going to be able to overcome because she's very obviously going to be only in those places for money. And then she's going to very obviously have a weird, you know, lilt to her accent all of a sudden when she goes to, mm-hmm. you know, some of these other swing states and pretends that she's from the Midwest again. Like,
right.
She's going to very obviously not care about cities. Whereas Obama, because he was from Chicago, felt like he understood cities. And you felt like he sort of was connected to urban voters. And so
right.
I feel like this would be a great way for them to sort of, to build an olive branch then with urban voters. To sort of, you know, have urban voters feel like they were cared about a little bit. But at the same time, I don't want them to do it because it's a pain in the ass. So,
right.
So those are the mixed feelings.
Those are real concerns.
Those are real concerns. Well, I remember the Republican convention. That was a disaster. Anyway, the Texas presidential straw poll happened.
Yes.
That's where we are right now.
Right. And it was at the Texas Republican convention, actually, that this happened. And, you know, a few of the people, three of the people who are thinking that they're going to be president in 2016, where they're two of them, you know, Texas homegrown folk.
Right.
The people that were there were Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, and Rick Perry, who's the current governor there, mind you. And it was like a Ted Cruz coronation at this thing. Like, nobody cared at all that Rick Perry was there, and he's their governor. He got, like, last in the straw poll, basically. He got, like, 11% or something like that. But Cruz got 43%, and the next closest was Ben Carson, who's doing the straw poll rounds right now. He's the fake candidate. He got 12.2%. Rand Paul got 12.1%, and then Rick Perry got 11.7%.
Poor Rick Perry.
Which is sort of sad. But Ted Cruz was, like, going around, like, he was being introduced at all of his, like, speaking engagements at the thing, like, as the next president of the United States. Everywhere he went, the crowd was yelling, "Run, Ted, run." I mean, it was literally, he was, like, a freaking rock star at this thing, which is really upsetting.
Really upsetting. But also kind of exciting, because Ted Cruz is not the most reliable candidate you could run for a national office, because he's a whack job.
No, I'm in.
Yeah, I'm
totally.
If I was there, I would have
also been cheering Run Ted.
No, of that slate, he is the least real person. And that is a slate that has Rand Paul on it. So I'm not talking about just any slate of people. He's the least real person in a slate that includes an actual fake candidate, Ben Carson, a crazy-eyed crazy person in Rand Paul, mm-hmm. and like a fake George Bush copy in Rick Perry. Right. Like that's saying something.
Have you watched last week's Veep yet?
No.
By the way.
Yes. Oh, the debate? Yes.
That was so good when they had her do when she couldn't remember her three R's.
Yes.
Last week on Veep, they had their first presidential debate because she's running for president now. Although I watched the finale and I won't ruin anything, but
Brent's about to give spoilers apparently. To me too, because I haven't watched it yet.
I won't do it. You haven't seen it. Only for you.
Have you only been watching TV for the last 2 days? You've watched all of Orange is the New Black, and you've already seen Veep. It's like...
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Okay.
That's all I've done.
Yeah.
I've left the house in like 50 hours.
I'm through 2.5 episodes of Orange is the New Black, and somehow in that amount of time, Brent has watched like all of them.
I watched all 13 of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm done.
Yeah.
So they had her in the debate last week, like, to have a very Rick Perry-style moment where she, forgot one of her immigration R's. She had, like, a 3-R plan for immigration. She couldn't remember the third R. Anyway, but also at this, at the state convention, they got to work on some real wingnut party platform situation.
They're not backing down from their outlier position where no one will vote for them.
Not only are they not backing down, they're, like, going back on a few reasonable things that they put in the platform as recent as 2012.
Yeah.
Because in 2012, they put this thing in their party platform where they were going to allow illegal immigrants to take jobs that were currently unfilled by American citizens. And that was the thing that they sort of, like, did because they sort of, like, saw the demographics writing on the wall. And so they were like, all right, well, we'll just put this in there. Overturned that.
Don't care about demographics anymore.
They would rather have the jobs go unfilled by all people than have you know, a Mexican take them, for God's sake. Anyway, so they did
that. This is in a state, by the way, that is going to go blue at some point because of the Mexican population. Like,
right. Yes, exactly.
This is the Texas GOP. They are on the border. They're not just some rando state in the middle of the country. This is a state where the demographic change issues are really real. So.
Yes. And speaking of that border, they called to totally secure it.
Yes.
And then also, they don't want to offer amnesty to anyone. They put that in there. No amnesty. None. And they also want to eliminate college tuition for illegal immigrants.
Is there a way that we can get rid of Ted Cruz by somehow strengthening the immigration laws?
I know, right? Well, I feel like we could.
If we can say this stuff about Mexicans, can't we get rid of Canadians too? Like,
I know. Well, Ted Cruz is currently a non-American who is holding a job that an American could
exactly
have as U.S.
exactly.
senator.
Yeah.
Like, I feel we should just put this party platform issue into place, and we could get rid of him.
Yeah. No. I mean, let them live up to their own principles on this.
Yes.
Let them voluntarily give it up when an American decides that they're ready to fill the job.
Yeah, exactly. But they also, they didn't stop at immigration. They also had to deal with gays, obviously, because that's a big threat in Texas.
Of course.
Homosexuality, they are they claim, tears at the fabric of society, which, like, I don't even know what that means. They would, well,
that's a fake thing to say. It doesn't mean anything.
I was going to say. And they also agreed on a policy of gay reparative therapy, which is like,
we know from science works super well.
Right,
that's historically been a real winner of a strategy. Mm-hmm.
But they, but on top of that, they also want to repeal the Voting Rights Act. They support open carry of firearms. They support the repeal of the minimum wage. They back a U.S. withdrawal from the United Nations. They prohibit the sale of the morning after pill and demand the repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
Really buried the lead here, because that's a crazy list of things.
That's a crazy list.
That's
of things.
The also they did list. Like,
I know.
Repeal the Voting Rights Act, like open carry laws, get rid of the minimum wage, get rid of the get out of the United Nations. Like, are they? Like, what?
Yeah.
That's, I mean, this is a platform of insanity. This is.
It is.
It's a real.
Well, it's a platform of Texas Republicans, so that's what you get.
Exactly. Meanwhile, speaking of misogynists, we had this weird story that we found in New York Magazine, which you probably found it too if you're a person who reads the news, because. Yeah. It was just in New York Magazine. It's not like we found it in some secret location.
Well, there was some drama earlier in the week, because there was this whole story about Vladimir Putin called Hillary Clinton weak. His direct quote was, "It's better not to argue with women, but Miss Clinton has never been too graceful in her statements. When people push boundaries too far, it's not because they are strong, but because they are weak. But maybe weakness is not the worst quality for a woman."
Speaking of burying the lead, why was that last sentence not the thing that everyone objected to? Like, who cares if he called her weak, but maybe weakness is not the worst quality for a woman? We're talking about a month where all we've talked about is, like, sexism in the workplace. Like,
I know.
It's insanity.
Yeah.
In any case, it turns out that this is not the first time that Vladimir Putin has run his mouth about silly women.
Not even close.
Because it turns out he loves to talk about how silly women are, and also how they are sexual objects that are not worthy of human-related respect, I guess. I don't know. New York Magazine pulled together, like, a bunch of terrible things that he had said. It's not the first time he's gone after Hillary Clinton. At one point, she was quoted as saying Putin didn't have a soul, so he said that Clinton didn't have a head. Because, you know, women are stupid. He also was talking about the Israeli Prime Minister, Moshe Katsava, or Katsav, is he the Prime Minister now? I don't even know what's going on.
No. I don't know. He was then Prime Minister or something like that. Yeah, he'd been accused of raping and sexually assaulting like a bunch of female subordinates, and so Putin was talking to someone, and he was overheard saying, "What a mighty man he turns out to be! He raped 10 women. I never would have expected this from him. He surprised us all. We all envy him." What? Yes.
Well, women are just there to rape. That's
they're there to rape.
That's what they're doing. That's all.
Yeah.
That's all you need them for. At Sochi, he told a young volunteer who had told him that it was a dream to meet him, "I'll pinch you later." Ugh.
Gross, yeah.
And then he was talking, there was some Pussy Riot-related demonstration, because there's always something going on. Like, I don't know how this, like, music act has turned into such a phenomenon over there, but, I mean, as a political phenomenon. But in any case, he was talking about a demonstration where one of the women from Pussy Riot, like, was in some sort of, like, public orgy or something like that.
Sure.
And he said, "Some fans of group sex say that it's better than one-on-one because, as with any collective work, you can skiv off." And then there was some feminist group in Ukraine that had topless protesters, and he said, "I like it. I did not catch what they were shouting. I did not even see if they were blondes, brunettes, or chestnut hairs." Chestnut hair. So he's gross.
He's totally gross.
Unexpected. Unexpected, as I'm sure it is, but
yes,
everyone who's seen his topless photos.
Ugh, God.
In any case, and now we can get to the real news, which is that Orange is the New Black was released, and Brent has seen all of it. I've only seen 2.5 episodes, so we're not going to have too many spoilers for you.
I'm not going to give you any spoilers, other than that it remains, like, the greatest thing that you'll ever see.
Unparalleled in television.
I was late to this party, as you know, and you pushed me into this party, so I thank you for that. But, like, this was, like, it's really is the best use of your time out there currently,
yeah,
right now.
Of course.
Like, you met, it was Gay Pride this week in Los Angeles, and I did not leave my house.
No, well, you had 13 hours of television to get through.
You were busy. Here's what I will tell you, though, that is a thing that needs to be happening more often, is that first I was talking to, one of our mutual friends, Lauren, was also watching it, and, like, she started watching it, like, when it dropped, like, you know, Friday at midnight or whatever, and I didn't, because I was asleep at that point already.
Right.
And I was like, okay, well, and we had talked about watching some of it this weekend, and I was like, well, we're going to have to sort of, like, if we're meeting on Sunday to watch it, then we're going to have to sort of, like, keep track of, like, where we are, or somebody's going to have to watch something they've seen already or whatever. And right. So, like, on Friday, we were like, well, let's allow ourselves 6 episodes, and then after 6 episodes, let's touch base with each other, and then we'll see if we want to allot ourselves more, or if we're done, and then we'll, like, pick up. It was, like, 2:00 Saturday afternoon, and we were texting each other, and we were like, okay, what do? We've watched 6 episodes now, because we both, like, started watching it immediately when we woke up on Friday, and, like, watched it all of Friday night, of course, and it's like, you just couldn't stop it. The sad thing about Orange is the New Black is that, and I know that you sort of binge-watched the first season, is that now it's over, and what do you do?
I actually like that about it. I was talking about that with a friend today, because I feel like with a show that goes on for a long time, you sort of, like, have, you spend a lot of time thinking about how you can't watch the show for another week, whereas I feel like this, there's a big buildup, and then you can just spend 13 hours watching it, and then it's over. Then it's like the assignment is complete. You've done it. You don't have to do it again. You can do it again if you want, I guess. But, like, then you can move on with your life. I like a show where you can just, like, sit down, watch it, and then be done, so you don't have the pressure of having not watched the whole thing. One of the things that I mean, and I feel like a show that can stand up to that kind of watching is probably a more exciting show anyway. Like, could you binge watch Grey's Anatomy? No, you would kill yourself. It would, like, the last few seasons of Grey's Anatomy, you would literally kill yourself before you would binge watch that show.
Yeah.
Now, I would argue that points to a declining quality in the show, because I did binge watch the first season of Grey's Anatomy and loved it. So I feel like it's a good sign when you can do this with a show, but it also, it at least, it gets it out of your hair. So I don't have to spend, like, another 2 months, like, waiting out this dumb nonsense. Like, I prefer to binge watch Veep. I wish that Veep would just come out all at once so I could just do that.
I know.
I'm not.
But what we did, so we finally basically just finished up until the point where we were at the finale, and then we went and watched the finale in her fancy screening room at her apartment building. It was awesome, and we ate our Japanese market candy.
I know. It was everything.
I basically felt like my entire life had been leading up to that moment.
Yeah, of course you did. That was that was like when all the things came together. You had Japanese candy, which is, I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast very much, but it's the greatest candy on earth. If you go to a Japanese supermarket, they're coming up with things that are insane.
I don't know how they're winning at candy like they are, but they are.
They're taking risks that we're not taking here. They're putting fuzzy things on gummy candy. It's like, how do you even know how to do that?
They're putting Pop Rocks in cotton candy.
Yeah.
They are putting soft gummies inside harder gummies. If you can think of it, then they're getting down to it.
Exactly.
And they're not worrying about, you know, not worrying about anything. They're just going for it.
Yeah, they're going for it. So that's already a great situation to be in. But then to also have a screening room in which to watch Orange is the New Black is like, I don't even know how you handled that.
It was hard.
Meanwhile, I learned yesterday that we almost had a Triple Crown winner, but then I also learned yesterday that we didn't.
I know.
I hadn't been following this story at all, and then I was forced to follow it for the moment that it was happening, because obviously these horse races take like a tenth of a second. Like, they happen so fast.
Well, and that's the thing. That's the thing about horse racing, because I watched this. I mean, I don't know how I had. I think I watched more I broke the space-time continuum this week.
Yeah, it sounds like you did.
I watched, from Friday, after I got out of work, I watched all of Orange is the New Black. I watched the finale, or the final of the French Open yesterday morning. I watched the Kings hockey game. I'm a hockey fan now, mysteriously. I don't know how that happened.
Terrible.
I watched the Belmont Stakes. I watched a little of the last U.S. soccer game before they go to the
World Cup
later in the week, which starts later this week. I watched the men's French Open final this morning, and then I watched a little bit of the NBA Finals game.
And you watched Veep.
When I got home. And I watched both episodes of Veep, which is now over, which I didn't even realize until tonight that it was the finale of that. So I don't know what I don't know how I did that.
No, that's like some real, that's a lot of television. I'm worried about your brain.
I know, it's sort of upsetting.
You think your brain is melting or something?
Now that I say it all out loud, I'm sort of embarrassed about it.
Yeah.
But whatever, fuck it.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do? You had to watch yeah. You had to watch Orange is the New Black. You didn't have a choice right. there. You
know? I feel like once I knew that I had to watch Orange is the New Black, I knew I couldn't leave the house
right,
at
no.
that point. So it's like,
right, so you just settled in.
Then, right, so then the other times that you're not watching Orange is the New Black, you just are sitting there. It's like, what do? You watch something else.
Anyway. Well, I don't watch as much TV this week so that you can do brain repair. So that
I know, I'm going to need to.
When if you end up having to watch any of the World Cup, you'll at least have your brain repaired yeah, in time.
I know. Well, did you hear the drama with the whole Triple Crown thing? Because the owner of California Chrome, who was the one going for the Triple Crown, called the winner a coward.
Oh.
Because here's the thing that's happening, and I actually sort of agree with him on this, although it's probably like not the greatest. You know, I'm sure horse racing is supposed to be more dignified than this, or maybe it's not. Who knows? But what happens is that everybody who doesn't win the Kentucky Derby then sits out for the Preakness so they can be fresh for the Belmont.
Oh.
So most of these horses, including the one who won the Belmont, did not race the Preakness.
Oh.
So they're fresh. They're fresher horses. Mm. So you, and this has happened recently a lot, like all of the recent horses that have like been able to like go for the Triple Crown have lost to a horse that didn't run in the Preakness.
Well, if I thought that horse racing was a legitimate sport, I'd be pretty upset about that.
I know, but
since,
it's not.
It's, since it's a ridiculous sport, I don't care.
Correct.
That's how I know.
Good.
Meanwhile, our final item is a story that we have no information about, which is just that rumor has it that Tracy Morgan is in critical condition after a bad car accident.
Yeah, he got in a really bad car accident. He was like in some, you know, SUV limo or something. And I think he got hit by like, there was somehow a Walmart truck involved. Somebody in the car died.
Oh, God.
And he has like a ton of broken bones. He's in critical condition. So like, we hope he's okay. But that's sad.
That was just,
I don't know why we ended on that story.
Well, on that terrible note.
Oops. Well,
we didn't have an agenda for a funny last story because we had all this Orange is the New Black business to get through. So we didn't.
I know. I know.
But anyway, that's the podcast for this week.
That's it.
So hopefully you were able to hear it.
It sounded okay.
Exactly. And next week, we might be coming to you a little late next week, but we might not.
Because you get back on Sunday, right?
I get back on Sunday, but not too late. So maybe we'll do it Sunday.
All right.
But whatever happens, you will hear from us next week, either on Sunday or Monday, right. And then you'll know.
That's right.
And with that, we say goodnight.
Bye.
Bye.